Carolina Journal is your source for daily news and commentary in North Carolina covering politics and public policy. A project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit and investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of public funds by public officials, including members of Congress and members of the North Carolina General Assembly. In season two of Extreme Injustice, North Carolina students and their families made life-changing sacrifices after state policies shuttered public schools across the state. Our deep dive into the unintended consequences of COVID lockdowns show the desperate need for new thinking in public education. School shutdowns due to COVID didn't occur in a vacuum. There were repercussions that extended well beyond academic declines only. Child safety has been a big one. A key way that child abuse is reported is through a child's interaction with teachers and counselors at their school. But with schools closed down due to COVID, instances of that reporting declined. One study published in the Journal of Public Economics put the number at over 200,000 unreported allegations just in March and April of 2020. Another study in the journal Child Abuse and Neglect estimated that figure at nearly 300,000 cases in the U.S. that went unreported from March through May in 2020 as well. Now, scholars Vladimir Kogan, an education policy expert, and Vinay Prasad, a physician and epidemiologist, have argued that the consequences of keeping schools closed are so significant that that course of action should only be followed in the most extreme cases. And they wrote in an op-ed recently, they said, quote, "We believe schools must remain open unless the local healthcare system is facing collapse. And that's due to capacity restraints. Short of such a scenario, the trade-offs favor doing everything possible to keep schools open." They also added, quote, "In many parts of the country that kept schools closed in fall of 2020, reports of suspected child abuse plummeted. And that suggests that thousands of cases are going unreported, and children are being isolated with their abusers. New evidence from Japan also shows that school closures have caused young children to gain significant weight, and some U.S. cities are seeing a disturbing surge in juvenile gun violence." Now, on that last point, cities in North Carolina and across the country have witnessed spiking gun violence during the pandemic. One case here in North Carolina from Durham is that 318 people were shot in 2020, compared to 189 people the year before in 2019. Now that is an astounding 68% surge. Most of the people who were responsible for the violence were also youths. Now, we've been looking at the child abuse implications more broadly and violence and societal ills, things like that. There have also been changes in the labor market that have been caused by schools shutting down. According to a census report in 2021, moms of school-age children have dropped out of the labor force in high numbers during the pandemic. In March and April of 2020, it's estimated that 3.5 million mothers living with school-age children left active work. They were either shifting into paid or unpaid leave, losing a job, or exiting the labor market altogether. Now, fully almost 50% of mothers of school-age children were not actively working in April of that year. Teachers in public schools have also been leaving the profession. A RAND Corporation report found that 25% of them were considering leaving the field, considerably more than in non-pandemic years. To illustrate the mental health consequences of school shutdowns, I want to share a story from a mom in Carteret County on the coast of North Carolina. Her name is Christine. She had to sit at home and endure the challenge of watching her son, Luke, his mental health deteriorate as he was stuck in exclusive virtual schooling month after month. Even after Luke returned to a hybrid approach in August of 2020, the on-again, off-again schedule didn't work for his learning style. During this time, Luke attended school 2 days a week, in person for partial days. The remaining 3 days were still virtual. Even when Luke was back in the classroom, he would just sit at his desk and complete the online assignments, the same as if he were back at home. By mid-October 2020, Christine realized that the hybrid learning was not working. It was taking a toll on Luke's grades. Before, he was an A or B student. Now, he had slipped to C's and D's. I interviewed her for an article, and she shared with me, quote, that Luke was embarrassed and ashamed. He is a 190-pound, 6'4 athlete, but he felt so defeated by the virtual learning. It's been so hard for him not being able to play sports at school, not having that exercise and social time, the time to be with coaches who help these young men transition from boys into men. All that has been taken away and erased. So as Luke's grades slipped, he spent more and more time on his smartphone and Xbox. Christine would fight with him to try to get him to complete assignments, but he was reluctant to do so, and she was reluctant to take away his technology because it was his only line of connection to the outside world. So the good news of the story is that Luke did return to full-time in-person instruction beginning in March of 2021, but a lot of the devastating effects had already been felt by then. And one thing in particular that Christine shared with me that I think is relevant is that she said, you know, we're an upper middle class family. We have jobs. We haven't lost our health insurance or income. We're going to figure this out. But if it's been hard for us, I can't imagine what it's been like for families without resources. And there are so many anecdotal stories like that of Christine and Luke's, just showing the mental health toll and the social toll that the school closures have had on students. Let's take a quick break now. When we come back, we're going to have a discussion here with Donna about the social ramifications of school closures here in North Carolina.
Extreme Injustice, an investigative project of Carolina Journal, is produced by the John Locke Foundation. For three decades, Locke has served as an independent, nonprofit think tank that works for truth, freedom, and the future of North Carolina. Locke envisions a strong North Carolina committed to individual freedom, personal responsibility, and limited constitutional government. To support our work, please visit johnlocke.org.
Carolina Journal is your source for news and commentary covering politics and public policy. As a project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of taxpayer funds by public officials, including members of Congress and the state legislature. Visit carolinajournal.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Extreme Injustice, Stolen Time. Today we're talking about the mental health and social ramifications of school closures due to the pandemic. We've talked about some stories from individual parents and showing just how much their students were impacted by having to do school in an exclusively virtual environment. A lot of academic studies have also borne out in the last few months, the last few years, the consequences of virtual-only schooling. There was actually one study by the CDC that reported that emergency room visits for mental health reasons for children and teens jumped by 24% and 31% respectively from April through October of 2020. Another review of the literature by UK researchers found that young people disconnected from school due to COVID-19 closures were as much as three times more likely to develop depression in the future, and the impact of that depression on their mental health could last up to 9 years later. Now, there was one example in Las Vegas public schools where they actually decided to reopen for in-person learning after seeing that 18 teen suicides had occurred in 9 months, and that was double the rate from the previous year. So Donna, I'd just love to get your thoughts broadly on and your experience as a mom of kids in high school during this time, just what you saw the mental health aspects being like, the social ramifications of the school closures.
Right. I mean, it was devastating. I can remember, we heard it was universal parents saying my child is isolated, their personalities are not the same, whether it was from the loss of a friend group or a sport or whatever kept them going during the day. Those interactions are critical. And we know that now, and whether that was addressed as so critical to their development education in the beginning, it feels like it wasn't. I remember in Transylvania County, there were two suicides of teenagers that really drew a lot of attention, brought a lot of focus to this issue in North Carolina particularly. It's not just about the isolation, because there is that Zoom factor. That isn't the same. It's not the same as having friends. It's not the same as attending group events and football games and having one-on-one learning with your teacher. It's also about children's, particularly teenagers, self-esteem, self-image is very tied to their academic performance. So when they are shorted in that instruction, but still required to maintain the same level of testing, the same level of turning homework in, the same level of performance in the classes where they're not receiving the instruction that they need, their grades fall, and their self-esteem, their self-image changes with that. So you see, you saw kids becoming more and more withdrawn from their parents, withdrawn from their peers, and in many cases, suicide levels did spike, mental illness spiked, you know, kids going on anxiety medications, all of this spiked during the pandemic. Recently, Cody Kinsley, the new DHHS secretary, spoke to a legislative committee about where they are today. Where is North Carolina today in this? Now, this dovetails in with children because to me it was interesting. He said North Carolina is now 94% of North Carolinians now have some level of immunity to COVID, whether it's from a prior infection or it's from a vaccine. 94%, it's over. I mean, basically, that's what we're saying. And he said that DHHS is moving from focusing on the collective risk, right, the risk to our communities of COVID, and focusing more on the individual risk of COVID, those with, compromised immune systems, age, those things. That's what struck me. Had we had that approach from the beginning, lives would have been saved because children, statistically, were already at a low risk. Schools, European studies have shown that schools were a low risk of transmission within a school building. So had we focused on individual risks from day one, after that 2 weeks, okay, 2 weeks, we're gonna be out for 2 weeks. Had the switch happened then, let's focus on individual risk rather than collective risk. I feel like the learning loss and mental health of our youth in North Carolina would be very different today.
And I feel like part of the problem was after that 2 weeks, or maybe during that 2 weeks, all of a sudden politics got
yes.
involved, and it became a political issue rather than one really of health or one of education or one of freedom, anything like that. It became a political football
sure.
that people were throwing around at that point. And that's part of what's been difficult with the whole thing.
It really has. A mask became a symbol of your not just compliance, but your political party. It really did. And so then children are now today, when they don't have to wear masks, you're seeing a lot of kids are still wearing them. They've become almost like a hoodie, a shield from their peers and a way to kind of hide what's going on in their minds and in their emotions. And so, you know, certainly infection is still an issue, and there are families that are still concerned about it. But a lot of kids are not taking the mask off because it's become a part of their self-identity through this crisis. And the 9-year point, that a 9-year to recover, I would argue that there's a lot of kids who won't recover from the emotional damage that happened during this time.
Another interesting part of this too for me is that I think there was some belief that maybe a Zoom class could be some approximation of what a normal
right.
class would be. When the reality is that Zoom class, it's still screen time for
sure.
that young person. So you're, you know, like the example from Christine and her son Luke, I mean, he was on Xbox all the time. He was on social media all the time. And then he's also on a screen all the time for his Zoom classes.
Yeah.
And we know that has dramatic mental health implications. So he had no time in an actual classroom. It was all screens mm-hmm. all the time. It's no wonder that we've seen mental health consequences from that.
Absolutely. And we're seeing disproportionately affecting girls and children from lower income families and families of color. One of the interesting things from a Pew Research study said that emergency room visits for suspected suicide attempts went up 51% among girls 12 to 17. And, you know, what that speaks to may be, you know, the dynamic of that girls tend to be more social. They're missing a bigger part of their lives when they move to online school, and the loss of a caregiver. In many cases, that teacher has been a caregiver for, to some degree, to some of the kids who are in classrooms, particularly if they are suffering from developmental or academic delay. So having that suddenly missing person out of their lives was really a challenge. And the ones who were able to kind of get through it are ones that in many cases came from maybe a higher income family that could replace some of those resources. And that means we're disproportionately affecting those who need the support the most. So the big question is, where do we go from here, right? A lot of families have tapped into their family resources, and if they have the ability, their health plans to try and get therapy and some real efforts to help their kids. A lot of kids have jumped right back into sports. That's helped. You can't overestimate the value of sports and music and all of these extracurricular activities that kids participate in for their mental health. And that's an important part of important factor in this criteria. Now, the state is requiring each K-12 public school to adopt and implement a plan for promoting student health, student well-being. They had to present that plan to DPI, Department of Public Instruction, over the summer and start implementing it. But one of this is really assessing where their students are and then developing a plan to help them. So for families in immediate crisis, that's something that they're really going to have to deal with on their own. And perhaps the public school system has a good counselor. They can talk to the ones that they've got there in their public school to benefit them. But overall, what we're really saying is that this learning loss, the loss of in-person education, all of these things really cause some, in some cases, irreparable damage to a lot of the students in North Carolina.
Great discussion today. Thank you, Donna. In the next episode of Extreme Injustice, Stolen Time, we'll again look at some of the issues related to children being brought home and virtual schooling exclusively due to the COVID pandemic. Tune in. Extreme Injustice is an investigation series from the Carolina Journal, the media project of the John Locke Foundation. Visit carolinajournal.com today and sign up for our free email newsletter to stay up to date on news from the state capitol and how it impacts your business, home, and community.